This episode of the American Birding Podcast is brought to you by HX Expeditions, offering mindful adventures to curious travelers since 1896. An HX Expedition cruise is the best way to see some of the world's rarest birds, like McKay's bunting. With onboard science centers, ornithologists, photographers, and a range of outdoor activities, an HX Expedition is a birder's paradise. Change the way you see the world. Book now and find out why birders are raving about HX. Hello and welcome to the American Birding Podcast from the American Birding Association. I'm Nate Swick. It is the end of the month, so it is this month in birding this week. And it's a fun one this time around. I know I always say that, but it's always true. Before we get to that, I just want to make a quick announcement about places you can find the ABA this spring. We will be at the biggest week in American birding this May, as we always are. I will be there along with a few of my colleagues leading trips, hanging out at the trade show and on the boardwalk, talking birds and the ABA. The speaker lineup looks fantastic and the birding is always very good. I hope to see you there. Come by and say hello. You can get information at biggestweekinamericanbirding.com. Also, I mentioned it last week. I'll mention it again this week. The Great Salt Lake Birding Festival is in Farmington, Utah. It is the next week after Biggest Week, May 16th through the 19th. The month of May is a very busy one for the birding festival circuit. You can learn about that at greatsaltlakebirdfest.com. Okay, let's get to it. Jody Allaire, Miko Jimenez, and Perbita Saha join me to talk about climate change in birds, skinny bird legs, and the weirdest place you've ever seen a good bird, all after this week's Rare Birds. This is your Rare Bird Focus for the end of March 2024. We have the first potential ABA area first of the year this week from Florida, whose exceptional 2023 is now leaking into 2024. A pearly-eyed thrasher was discovered this week at the Botanical Gardens in Key West, the site of many great birds over the years. This species is a fairly common resident throughout the Eastern Caribbean as far north as the Bahamas and is sort of a notorious avian colonizer with the ability to fill unexploited niches throughout the islands to the point where it, as a nest predator and a nest site thief, is partially blamed for depleted bird life on a number of Caribbean islands, this according to Birds of the World. In fact, with the exception of Puerto Rico, where pearly-eyed thrasher primarily inhabits disturbed habitat with few native species, it is most common on smaller, relatively species-poor islands, which it should be said does include Key West. It is notably absent from the large islands in the Caribbean like Cuba, Hispaniola, and Jamaica. It is a species with a fascinating biology and one whose large size and aggressive predatory habits could theoretically make it a problem if it were to naturally expand onto the continent, but whose generalist ecology have made it unlikely to do so, as it apparently has trouble competing in places with other larger generalist bird species. Part of the reason why it's not on the larger Caribbean islands. That is what we have this week. For the full list, check out the ABA Rare Bird Alert on Fridays at aba.org/RBA. You can also follow along with all the rare bird news in our ABA Rare Bird Alert group on Facebook and on ABA Community. Beware the IDs of March. Perhaps Shakespeare was a birder who was, no doubt, concerned with molting grebes, singing juncos, and various other birding difficulties brought to us by this month. Considered by some the most boring month for birding in the ABA area. Not anyone here, of course. We are all professionals who care about birding every month of the year. We've got a great panel of birders for this month of birding, ready to tackle whatever this month can throw at us. Let me introduce them. First up, our friend from the Northern Reaches of the ABA area. He is the Director of Community Engagement with Birds Canada and a producer of the Warblers podcast. Welcome back, Jody Allaire.
Hey, great to be here, Nate.
It's great to see you. Next up, an arrow ecologist currently based in Colorado. It is Miko Jimenez. Hello again, Miko.
Hey, Nate. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Wonderful to see you. And she's a science writer and editor, formerly of Popular Science and Audubon, and currently on her way to be a hawk watcher at Anzo Borrego State Park in California. Hello again, Perbita Saha.
Hi, Nate and friends. Hello, everyone.
It's good to have you. I'm glad you're all here. Let's start with what was probably the greatest moment of collective anxiety yet documented in the birding world. The great eBird outage of 2024. eBird along with the Macaulay Library and Birds of the World, were down for a few days last week as the Cornell products transitioned to new servers. It left birders in a lurch. I, for one, did not realize how frequently I rely on Cornell resources just to answer quick questions about birds in the moment. I was a little disconcerting to type any of those websites into my URL tab. My fingers do it automatically these days and immediately realize my mistake. And I didn't even have any checklist to submit over the period. How did you, esteemed panel, handle this existential birding crisis?
I put it on my Google Calendar.
Did you really?
I thought Cornell did a great job of teeing everyone up for it.
Yeah.
They sent emails. They posted on social media. And birders were still so confused.
Yeah.
I also feel like they came back online before they promised.
It did.
So,
like,
it's a solid strategy.
18 hours early. Too much fanfare.
Yeah, I would second Perpita. Like, I felt like I knew it was coming and it was fine. But my local group chats were like blowing up. There's clearly folks who didn't know. And if you've ever needed evidence, you know, listing is like, can be like an addiction. There were folks who were just flipping out. And then like, once they got the news, it's like, it's fine. It'll be back up. Don't worry. I had a friend who was so funny because she's kind of like, she's a birder for sure, but she doesn't really use eBird very much.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, she texted me the one day she was looking for the sandhill cranes that are passing through right now in Fort Collins, like just north of town, in the ag fields out there. And she's like, the one day when I want to go out and find sandhill cranes and use eBird to do so, it's down. And so it's just funny timing there.
Yeah, it's amazing how much we rely on eBird.
It's a little
everything.
Scary. Actually.
It's a little bit scary. I knew it was coming. I used the app, still did my checklists and just saved them and just uploaded them after it went online. So it didn't, didn't really affect me too much, but yeah, it's become a habit for a lot of people. Right. And, you know, and I've been since before the pandemic, I've been trying to I have been doing checklists a day, you know, so I was keen to make sure I was still getting those in while there was an outage. And it's, you know, it's didn't want to stop now, right? I wanted to keep going for that, even, you know, and it's obviously nowhere near others in terms of like daily checklist challenge. I think I'm like somewhere in the ballpark of like 17,000 days behind Ted Floyd in terms of numbers of checklists. But I don't know. The app makes it pretty easy to still enter checklists without and not needing to submit them right away. So I don't know. But yeah, lots of panic. Lots of people didn't realize it was coming. That was pretty funny.
Well, I knew eBird was going to be down. I did not realize that like Birds of the World would be down too. Cause I was like, oh, I'm going to learn something about it. Something popped up on social media. I forget which website. It could have been any of them. Everyone's so spread out anymore. It was a question that I knew Birds of the World could answer for me. So I immediately go over to Birds of the World and nothing. Everything's down. I'm like, oh, come on. And
I did that as well. And I was really embarrassed. I'm like, I can't believe I just tried to look something up. Birds of the World. Yeah.
Yeah.
Happens to all of us. Yeah.
Yeah. And range maps, like I use range maps all the time on eBird. And it was frustrating to not to have that. Here's another kind of follow-up question. Cause I know all three of you are eBird users. eBird was moving to new servers. That's why they were down. Imagine the worst happens and all that information is gone. How screwed would you be if eBird simply ceased to exist on a scale of 1 to 10?
Depend on it a lot more when traveling now. Like, you know, I'm going to be in San Diego for a few days and I was trying to look up hotspots that I haven't hit yet. And eBird is the first go-to. I think I would be okay local birding wise. Although that does remind me that I used to keep a paper life list and I don't think I've been updating that. So that's a good reminder that you need to back up all your birding data.
At least the
multiple
first time
mediums.
You've seen something. Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's going to, if that's ever going to happen, but.
It'd be like the end of the world that would come, like the only thing that would end. We'd have bigger problems. Yeah.
That exact thought occurred to me too. It's like, what would happen if eBird just disappeared? Like we lost all of our data all of a sudden. Like, and that would be tough. That would be a tough day for sure.
I don't think I could replace my checklist from memory. I couldn't. Mm. I don't even know if I could replace my ABA area checklist from memory. I, like you, Perpita, I used to keep my checklist back, you know, in the pre-internet days on lined paper. in a binder that I kept. And then I moved it over to an Excel spreadsheet when I put it on on computers. And that I don't know where that Excel spreadsheet is gone. Like, I transferred everything over to eBird. And if it were gone, I would be screwed. I'd be very screwed. Might even be worth like quitting birding, just hanging them up. And like, nope, can't get this back. It's over.
Yeah, I've based a lot of my research questions and research career on the idea that there is this database. It would be, that'd be something. I wonder if do we have any examples of in that period, were there any like really cool rarities that popped up? You only could find out about it from a local message group or anything like that? Because like, I feel like as a newer birder, I got less of that. And yet, like, yeah, do you know what I mean?
You would, but you wouldn't hear about them immediately. You would hear about things a week later, 2 weeks later, a month later, and before it would disseminate to other parts of the country. You had to be in on the, you know, the continent-wide birding phone lines, phone trees, I guess, to hear about something like a whiskered tern in Cape May.
Yeah.
And then hopefully you heard about it within the period that it was there and you could go find it. Now, you know, obviously with eBird and to a lesser extent, things like Facebook and Reddit and all the channels where they report rare birds, you hear about it within the hour, and we're so used to that. But yeah, no, you wouldn't hear about it. And that's part of the reason why this is a question like, gets to the whole UK versus North American Twitcher community and how UK is so much smaller. And so the Twitcher community is that much bigger and the island is smaller so people can get around it relatively quickly. But that's, can never be the case in North America, Birds get seen out in California and it's like on another planet for a birder on the Eastern time zone. So
I was rereading Kingbird Highway and it makes, makes that whole, like all of Ken Kaufman's whole journey so much more impressive.
Oh, any
like, it's
gear.
So wild. Yeah. It's so
cool. You had to have all sorts of connections to all sorts of local birders and all sorts of communities to even like get that stuff on your radar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It makes Mark of Masek's, story, the big year story, almost all the more impressive since that was pre-internet for the most part.
Yeah.
I think that would be really fun to do a tech-free big year.
Tech-free big year.
That's
maybe
a good
in
idea.
A couple years for me, but
maybe. Yeah, well, after civilization collapses, we'll all be on that.
Yeah, there will be plenty of time for birding then.
That's right. Absolutely, no shortage of time.
Spring migration coming up. I think we're all excited, to see the migrants pass through our local patches. But for a lot of folks who work in conservation, particularly in cities, it's also a time where we kind of brace ourselves. Like, we know that these big migration nights, while they're really exciting, also often lead to big collision events. So I think most listeners are probably going to be familiar with this idea, but, as birds migrate at night, they often get drawn into these brightly lit urban landscapes, and they're more likely to collide with glass buildings. We've known that this has been an issue for a long time, and yet it still persists as a major conservation threat, despite kind of mounting callouts and research focused on it. And so this past month, there was a piece led by Andrew Farnsworth and a few other ornithologists, essentially arguing that the science is clear and we know what kinds of actions we need to take to curb, collisions. And that if we want to make any progress on this issue, essentially there needs to be a legal consequence enforced through the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. There's a lot of detail in here, but maybe just to kind of succinctly make their point, I'll highlight one of the examples that they center on. So, as I said, there's a lot of research going on to understand and mitigating collisions. And one example of that is a study that came out a few years ago, which noted Chicago as a city where birds are most exposed to anthropogenic light at night. And within that city, we have a ton of data showing that there's a convention center, the McCormick Place, which is kind of right on the lakefront. And we know that it's a major collision site historically and presently. And then even within that building, because of a study done by Benjamin Van Doren, we've even quantified estimates of how much we can reduce collisions if we turn off lights in a single window bay. And then we have tools like Birdcast, we have bird-friendly windows, window decals. And then on top of that, there's a ton of folks in Chicago I know that are advocating and studying this exact issue. Just this past fall, there was a major collision event where about 1,000 birds died across, collided with that building at that specific McCormick Place across 30-some species in one night. So this example just really makes their point, right? The science is super clear, even on this specific building. But there's kind of limits to the science and advocacy. There needs to be some legal intervention that ultimately results in the consequences in the form of fines and fees by enforcing the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So I thought this was a pretty insightful article. I don't really think that much about, I'm not really a big, I don't think that deeply about policy, I guess I'll say. It's not something I dive into the details of. And so this was, I think, a helpful kind of overview of maybe some of the stumbling blocks and why this isn't happening yet.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was a really great piece, and I agree with it wholeheartedly. The issue, I think, and this is just to be clear, I 100% agree with the prescription that was put out by Farnsworth et al. On what should be done about this. It is a big change from how the Migratory Bird Treaty Act has been enforced in the past, and it changes this from a wildlife / environmental issue to a public policy issue. And while I am all in favor of using the Migratory Bird Treaty Act as a legal weapon to go after some of these people who are clearly not learning the lessons of these constant bird strike events, it's a hard sell to get to establish the law enforcement mechanism to do that, to establish the process to make this happen. The cynic in me says, I don't see it happening and I don't know how it happens. But, what is a cynic but an idealist, a realistic idealist? I don't know. I really want that. I would really love to see this happen. Whether it does happen, I'm not sure. But 100% here for changing how we apply the Migratory Bird Treaty Act in these cases.
Yeah, I'll quickly say I get that perspective for sure. And I think it's it is interesting, their framing around, they kind of allude to some of that of mm-hmm. we initially, the year's 1918 and they instituted this act really to curb things like over harvesting and over hunting and the feather trade, right?
And it worked.
Yeah. And over 100 years later here now, the threats are so different. And they have this opinion, obviously, that it should be how that gets enforced should reflect that. Mm-hmm. I hear you, though. It's potentially more complicated than that. And it is a pretty big shift away from the original intention.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll jump in and just say, I totally support the premise of this. This is one of the acts that actually crosses borders and is relevant in Canada as well. And this issue has been discussed across Canada in large urban centers, right? And
a lot of them right on the Great Lakes, and
that's right. And Toronto, Toronto's been sort of the front and center for this in Canada. And a really good group of folks, the Fatal Light Awareness Program, have been pushing for legislative change and municipal guidelines, to really make this building owners accountable in these particular situations. But I think one of the things I wanted to bring up in this article is that it did reference the topic of incidental take, which is a really interesting concept because that is also something that's been discussed heavily here in Canada, especially in relation to the forestry industry, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're obviously removing tons of habitat and potentially killing lots of birds depending on the timing, right? But it's not the intent to kill those birds. It's the intent to have a building or to log an area for whatever purpose, right? So the incidental take is sort of this difficult side concept of how do you deal with that? How do you deal with the issue of it wasn't the intention to kill all those birds. It just sort of happened because we did this thing, but that wasn't our plan to kill the birds. Should they still be punished for that? And I would argue that using the Migratory Bird Treaty Act in an enforcement perspective, I think would actually be a good thing here because it would hopefully change some of these policies so that these things, wouldn't happen. But it's very difficult. And I'm certainly skeptical that we're going to see that it will be used to that degree. But my hope is that there will be some even just regional victories within communities. I know there's lots of good people out there up here in Canada that are fighting this battle, especially with windows. And I'd certainly like to see that done leading into what the next topic will be. But I think that the thing is that it's just exacerbated by all the other threats that these birds are dealing with right now. So the idea of evolving off the feather collection motive and egg collecting motive And moving on to addressing the challenges right now, every little bit is going to help because there's so many different threats from different directions now facing a lot of our birds.
I think what's unique about this is it's not just one industry or one bad actor, right? Like,
yeah,
with incidental take, I think when Jody was talking about that, I immediately thought about what's going on with the wind industry and turbines. But this isn't just the wind industry. Like, glass buildings are pervasive within commercial, residential, universities are sometimes some of the worst offenders. So if, you know, whatever action would be taken on the MBTA's accord, that would be like really huge, and it would just spread across a lot of different groups and a lot of different agents, which it can be done. I mean, that's how the Migratory Bird Treaty Act was created, and that's why it does reach across three continents. But I wonder, like, what solutions are there other than lights out, which has been effective in, you know, local communities, and, you know, bird safe glass alternatives, which are still, you know, being experimented on and still kind of, you know, on the fringe in terms of being adapted.
Yeah, I think the concept of incidental take is a really interesting one, because then it becomes, you know, who decides what is incidental? Who decides, does that change from year to year? Is there a sliding scale? Does it change from species to species? I don't think that, you know, a yellow-rumped warbler is treated all that much differently from a palm warbler in these sort of situations. They're pretty much all thrown into the same bucket, even though, you know, in the case of this McCormick Place incident, they made up something like 80 to 90% of the total take of that one event. Once you get into this realm of public policy and government action and regulatory action, it gets a lot of people involved that perhaps don't have birds at heart. Maybe they're pencil pushers. Maybe they just don't always see birds in the way that we do. And we're, you know, obviously very passionate about this. They're less so. How to reach that, and how to get these concepts across to people is one that I think is going to be a struggle. And I'm not, again, I feel like I'm being too much of a pessimist on this, because I'm not really. I really do think that the MBTA is such this wonderful law and this useful tool to affect this positive change for how these birds interact with urban landscapes. But man, it's a big move, and it's a big stretch pull, I guess is the word I'm looking for. And yeah, but it's got to start somewhere, and it's got to start with people like Farnsworth and this crew putting it out there. So yeah, hopefully maybe it gets some traction. We'll see.
Yeah. I definitely hear and understand that skepticism, and like, you know, this gets really, I don't know if convoluted or like, I guess complicated really quickly. I hear what you're saying with the policies like this. I think for me, like the bigger idea here is, or I don't know if it's the bigger idea, but for me, something that kind of switched as I read this was just like, I so often have this thought of like light pollution and collisions. I think of it as a kind of like a lot of the solutions I think of, like lights out programs, which Peter brought up, you know, they're bottom up, right? They're these ideas of folks, you know, some spreading awareness and a lot of, you know, essentially the public taking action. This is whether the MBTA is the right lever to pull or what it is, like some amount of top down pressure seems like a really useful thing to get to Jody's point of, you know, there are a lot of threats to migratory birds, and there should be, you know, commensurate, I guess, a lot of levers that we're pulling that aren't just bottom up. And so I think that's my bigger thing. I so often frame this issue as a bottom up solution, or that there are bottom solutions to it, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Well, ultimately, we want to move the needle on it. There's going to need to be some top down pressure.
Yeah. Like, exactly.
It's going to need this sort of, you know, governmental regulatory heft to make these changes happen. And whether that comes from pressure from bottom up, then, I mean, it typically does. You just got to get to that tipping point. In these environmental issues, it does feel like when you get to that tipping point, it's very, very slow, very, very slow, very, very slow progress. And then when you get that tipping point, then it does happen, and it can happen pretty quickly. And it's just getting to that point is hard, and a lot of people like get burnt out before you get there. But as long as you've got enough people pushing to get to that point, then, you know, maybe we'll get there. You know, an article in PNAS seems like a good indicator of getting to that place, but again, I have no idea.
There is a cool nugget in this paper and this is some insider information. So Kyle Ooh. Horton, who's my advisor, made the bar chart figure that's on this paper.
It's a lovely bar chart. I just want to point out that the figures are very nice.
I'm hoping he hears this. He told me this morning that he was playing around with different color schemes. And he landed on, there's color schemes that you can use that are based on the different Taylor Swift albums.
No way.
And he used the Speak Now album cover color scheme, which, like, Speak Now, right, like, goes along with the whole theme of the piece, which I think is pretty cool.
Oh, man. Talk about an Easter egg.
Yeah. It's deep in there.
I see it now. I see it. My daughter's a Swiftie. I've seen it. There are worse people to take cues from than Taylor Swift these days. So, yeah.
Fair.
This is sort of, a continuation of Miko's theme in terms of impact on birds. And this one is talking about climate change and bird migration. This is not a new topic. And this is, you know, obviously... For 20 years, we've been talking about what are the impacts of climate change on our birds, whether that's through habitat alteration over time, whether that's, you know, affecting timing of migration. And I think, so there's been several papers on this topic. We're getting more and more data, and it's all really still feeding into the same narrative that as the world is warming, our migratory birds are suffering. But I think there's some nuance here that I think it's worth talking about, because I feel like, and maybe this is more in the Canadian media cycle, but this has been a really hot topic of late up here. That was for you, Nate. Sure. And the because we've had like a, you know, pretty massive El Nino, right? And mm-hmm. we've had a very strange winter, and we're having, you know, pretty, even though we're getting half a meter of snow as I'm speaking right now out here in Southern Alberta, but we are getting a very early spring across the board, across Canada. And a lot of things are showing up much earlier. And there's a lot of discussion people want to talk about. It's like, hey, you know, the birds are coming back early. You think trees are starting to bud. Like, this is very, very unusual. I'd like to really chat about sort of the nuance about how climate change really does affect bird migration. And of course, this all came from just a paper that was published just like 2 weeks ago from the proceedings from the National Academy of Sciences. The paper is called Decoupling of Bird Migration from the Changing Phenology of Spring Greenup. You know, it's a great paper. The researchers looked at 20 years of vegetative greenup, like across North America, and they sort of compared that with looking at eBird data in terms of the arrival of birds to see sort of how things changed. And of course, the results were as you would predict. The results really fell in line with, you know, what people and organizations like Birds Canada, we've been talking about for more than a decade, right? And that long distance, especially in long distance near tropical migrants, are being negatively impacted specifically because of the asynchrony that's created between when vegetation greens out, when all the insects, peak insect abundance is early on, and when birds arrive. And I think one of the discussions that I've been having now, even with like the, you know, one of our national newspapers just a couple of days ago, I was talking about this topic. There are sort of two groups of migratory birds, right, that come into North America. There's the short distance temperate or facultative migrants, right? So these are the, you know, the tree swallows, the American robins. You know,
facultative migrant is one of my favorite ecology terms.
Yeah, I know. I should put it back in the textbook, I suppose. But yeah, like that's right. Right? It's birds that are not migrating as far. They can, and waterfowl are the classic ones, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, they can smell open water from like who knows how far away, right? Like they just know that a lake 100 kilometers north is thawed and they're gone, right? Mm-hmm. So these are birds that can adapt to a changing climate and arrive early on their territories. Now, that could shoot them in the foot if they like a tree swallow or purple martins. You know, if you arrive like really early and all of a sudden you get a cold snap, that actually could be pretty bad. But for the most part, it's very advantageous, right? And they could potentially start nesting earlier. Maybe they even get another brood out. They could take full advantage of the resources. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, our migratory birds aren't all short distance migrants. We have quite a lot of our birds, especially up here in Canada, especially the ones that nest in the boreal forest. are these long distance neotropical migrants. So birds like vireos and warblers and several flycatchers and thrushes. These are birds that winter in Central America and in South America. And they are not able to adapt to an early spring. They have no idea there's an early spring going on. So I think it's worth diving into why that is, right? And I think this is an evolutionary adaptation that has come from, you know, the ice age, right? Since, mm-hmm. you know, it was an adaptation for them to, you know, realize that they migrate further north, they expand their territories, they get to areas where there's tons of food and not much competition. It was totally worth it. It was an actual really good strategy. And if you've ever spent time up in Canada during peak bug season, you will know why,
yeah.
right? It is buggy. And it makes total sense. And now that strategy is not paying off the way it used to, right? And this study and many others have looking at this are showing that a lot of these long-distance neotropical migrants are arriving when they used to arrive. They're still arriving using the long-term average of when, you know, green-up happens and when peak insect abundance occurs, you know? Yeah, and I think the insect abundance is an interesting one too. I think there's, the question came up was like, well, you know, the insects start coming out in like May or whatever. Aren't they just out for the summer? And that's certainly our perception with mosquitoes, right? There's like always mosquitoes, but it's actually not the case, right? You've got these massive boom, like things like mayflies, right? And chironomids, midges.
Mayflies is right in the name, boom period. I mean, that's why they call them that.
There you go. That's the way naming needs to be done, right?
That's right. Very, very Nailed. Descriptive. Could not get Nailed more it. Descriptive. They fly in May. It is literally in May the name. Right on
flies.
The
tip. Yeah. 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 And they may fly and they may not too, right? Depends on the, on the one. So there is a big boom of insects, right? Like early on in the season, like midges are like one of the big ones, right? And that doesn't happen throughout the summer, right? So birds are trying to capitalize on this. The long distance, you know, tropical migrants are insectivores. And they need this. So they're flying a massive migratory journey up into the boreal forest of Canada in a lot of cases. They need to arrive at that sort of peak abundance, for one, so that they can rehabilitate themselves, right? This is a heck of a journey for these birds. And in many cases, loss of suitable stopover habitat and things like pesticide use, it is becoming a lot harder for these birds to even fatten up en route. And the classic example, of course, is the red knot for that one, you know, in terms of high Arctic nesting shorebirds, it's the same issue. And so they need the insects to like get healthy again, because they'll like full on dive into their muscle tissue, like in terms of digesting everything they can in order to fuel the migration. They get there, they need to do that. And then it's, you know, set up a territory. If they're lucky, they find a mate, they have eggs, and then there needs to be enough food for the chicks. And if you're off by several weeks, there may not be enough food for you to survive or to make it through that journey. You may not even reproduce. If you do reproduce, you might be having less eggs or less chicks, and their chick survival might go down. And I think these birds, like, I know they're small and delicate and whatever, but they are tough and they are resilient and they can handle that once in a while, right? Their population can handle that, but they can't handle that year after year after year after year. And one good year in 10 is not going to be enough, right, to keep that population going. So what is the result? The result is what we're seeing across data sets, but even in especially in Canada, if you look at State of Canada's birds, that entire group of birds, long distance, you know, tropical migrants are declining, right? All declining, regardless of what family they're in. And it is a real issue, right? So the study again just doubles down on this, you know, showing that there is, you know, the long distance migrants are showing up right when they're supposed to. But short distance migrants can adapt, right? But it's the long distance ones that we have to worry about. There's a whole pile of fact, window collisions, outdoor cats, you name it. And so we need to be acting on all different fronts to try to help these birds. But it's a climate change one is the X factor in all of this, because it is by far the biggest hurdle to deal with. And it might be the thing that really, makes it really difficult to recoup these populations. Anyway, I'll stop yammering on here, but good.
Yeah, it's great. And obviously an issue that is on the forefront of a lot of birders' minds this time of year, as much as any. I have one just minor kind of phenology anecdote to share to this end. I have lived here in North Carolina for just over 20 years now. Time flies. And when I first moved here, you could tell spring was coming by the blooming periods of three species of flowering plant. So it was dogwoods, redbuds, and wisteria, which is a purple flower vine. And usually it would be like redbuds first, dogwoods, wisteria, usually 1 week after another. That's the way it was when I first moved here. Like you could drive down the highway and you'd see the dogwoods start blooming and they're pink and white. And then the next week you'd see the redbuds start blooming. And then after that, the purple flowered wisterias. Now, these days, they all bloom at the same time. And so they've all kind of compressed into this same brief period. What that means for those plants, I have no idea. Maybe it means nothing to them, but it is sort of a visual indicator of how things have changed, even where I live, even just in the relatively brief period of time that I have lived here and noticed it. So I was thinking about that as I saw the red buds on the side of the road a couple weeks ago. And we don't have as many wisteria here as we did when I lived further east, but all at once.
Something that me and my fellow female bird enthusiasts talk about is how when we do some of these climate change scale studies, you know, we're looking at birds across an entire range. We're not even going on the species level sometimes. And even when we do go on the species level, we're not going on the sex level. So especially when we talk about phenology and migration, males and female birds migrate at different times. Usually in spring for many species, the females are coming up later. And in fall, it's reverse. Though not for all, you know, like phalaropes, I think the females come up first. So we don't even know sometimes, you know, are the males getting the short end of the stick because they're coming up too early, or like what's happening with, you know, the availability of resources once the females do get up, what's happening with juvenile birds, you know, in fall. So, I mean, doing these large scale studies is kind of the start. I think a lot of ornithologists and conservationists are thinking about how to take it on a more, you know, detailed level to really understand what individual birds are experiencing.
Yeah, that's a good point. That nuance can have very strong conservation implications.
Yeah. And it goes to show the sort of biases in the way that people did science in previous decades that were, you know, take some time to undo.
Yeah. One other thing I think I echo a lot of what's been said. I also find myself thinking as I was reading the study, you know, as bird people, obviously we think about the effects on bird populations, and that's kind of our metric. It's definitely the metric that I think about most often. But also like knowing, I find myself curious how this ripples out into an ecosystem, right? So we know that birds are seed dispersers, sometimes at a hemispheric scale, right? We know that they're dispersing nutrients just because of, you know, how far they're moving. They're part of these macro scale ecosystem processes. And you wonder, you know, particularly if it's the long distance migrants that are suffering, you know, what gets lost in that system? How will this ripple out, and what other types of, you know, how will this affect things like plant migration, right? And you can just keep going with the nuance, I guess. You can just keep going with, like, you know, to Jody's point, it feels like it's all, there's a lot of factors to consider here, and like it's a big intertangled system that's really hard to figure out.
I don't know if any of you are phenology fans more generally. You probably are. But I saw that the hardiness scale for plants and planting was just updated for the first time in several years, many years, this month. And there are new maps out showing what plants can survive at what latitude or what region in the United States. I mean, that doesn't show it. I don't know what does. These ripple effects that manifest not only in the way that the organisms, the wild organisms, interact with their environment, but the way the humans interact with our environment too. Mm-hmm. It's troubling, and I don't know what the answer is to it, but it's just things you notice.
Well, I think the answer is we need to start doing something about climate change. Right? We need to, like, I think...
I don't know about you, Jody. I'm talking about it on my podcast, so clearly I'm... you know, making some waves here.
There you go. That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I was talking to the ether. I was talking to the
into the air. But,
yeah. And I know this is all focused on birds, right? And we talk about birds, and birds are important indicators of environmental change. It's one of the reasons they're so great to monitor. They're just the best monitoring tool, I guess, in that regard. But they're obviously so much more, right? Mm-hmm. And this story and what the birds are, you know, showing us with these long-term population trends, the data is showing us more than just, well, we're seeing fewer Blackburnian warblers or fewer olive-sided flycatchers. It's showing us that we're having, you know, we're really doing a number on our planet in a variety of different ways. We're doing a number on our planet, and it'll affect more than just birds, right? It affects us. It affects whole landscape changes, right? And it's a bit scary. And I find, you know, I'm really excited about spring migration, like when it gets here after the snow melts.
E-birds here, birds are coming.
E-birds back. All
good. Yeah.
Snow's going to melt in a couple of weeks, hopefully. My God, hopefully. And birds will be here, and it's optimistic, and it's there. But you know what? Like I still feel this a lot more now than I did when I was a teenager, like starting out birding. It was all about like seeing all the warblers and like, you know, enthusiasm through the roof kind of thing. But now I'm pumped to have the Western Tanagers come back. I'm pumped to have the mountain bluebirds come back out here. But I think about this more. I feel this now, right? A lot more. And I'm sure I'm not the only one, right? When I'm out birding, you know, and you have a good migration day. It's like, I still think about this and the paces we're putting these birds through. And I don't know. It's a big one, right? It's a big issue, and it's not going away. And a lot needs to happen on so many levels to do a course correction. I hope we can. I hope we do it.
That's part of the reasons why I moved you to the middle segment, so we can end with Perbita's topic.
Sorry, everyone.
There's a reason there are canaries in the coal mine, man. So
now for something very different. honestly, a great question, kind of a stoner question, but I am very grateful that Asher Elbin, who's one of my favorite bird freelancers at Audubon, who wrote up this story for Scientific American, has no particular hook. It's just evergreen question. Mm-hmm. Why are bird legs so skinny? And as most good bird questions go, it ties back to the fact that birds are dinosaurs and direct descendants of them. So basically, the explanation has to do with when birds and their ancestors made the transition from bipedalism to flight, which in itself is a very fascinating topic. Still lots of debate about exactly how it happened, when it happened. Some paleontologists and ornithologists think it happened, that evolution happened multiple times, but it gave us the form of birds today, which there are many forms, but in general, we've got skinny little feet, skinny little legs. And what's interesting that I haven't thought about much is birds have horizontal thighs. So their knee is kind of, as Asher explains in his article, their knee is kind of like the highest point of their leg. And this is pretty unique to any group of animals. And that just means that pretty much all of their leg is tendon. It's not muscle. Whereas, you know, humans and mammals and most other animals have muscle in their legs throughout, birds are not using their legs to walk. So they have lost much of that muscle up to the point of, you know, their thighs and where their legs attach to their body. This means that they still have a lot of power in their legs because they perch. And there's kind of like another small question buried into this answer, which is how do birds perch while they're sleeping and not fall off a tree branch? It's because all that tendon just locks on to whatever they're grabbing. So they kind of have this superpower of being able to grab onto something, but at the same time, they have these scrawny little legs. There are some birds, of course, that are still flightless. Ostriches, for example, one of my favorite things to do when I'm bored is to look up ostrich thighs, because underneath all that feather, they have like dad bods. Like they are very muscular thighs, and they're big weird thighs. Kind of flesh colored. Like they look like bodybuilders. Thighs save lives.
Yep.
Yeah, it's really weird. So there are some birds that have retained muscle through in their legs. But in general, it's because birds fly and their center of mass is different.
Yeah.
And they just don't use their legs as most other organisms do. I did learn interesting fact that the Guinness World of Records for the animal with the biggest legs proportional to their body size is the black-necked stilt. Their legs are 60% of their entire body's length.
100%. I see it. Yep.
Yeah. But it does, I mean, for now that, like, you know, beach season is coming up, one of my favorite things to do when I can't identify all the sandpipers on the beach is to just watch the sanderlings. And they move so fast. Like, they've got, even if they don't have power in their legs, they're legs are like machines. So I am very curious, you know, what I'm sure it has to do something with the dynamics of the sand and the water and everything. But I would love to know more about how sanderling legs work, because they've tapped into something totally different evolutionary wise. And it's very cool.
I would love to see someone put a sanderling on a treadmill and like slow motion videotape how it's moving. So someone out there needs to do that. Some enterprising bird researcher who thinks they could put a sanderling in a cage, make it run.
A hamster wheel.
Yeah, a hamster wheel.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
They've done it there. So, yep.
I love the fact that all the answers to like sort of why birds questions are because they fly. It's like, why do birds have hollow bones? Because they fly. Why do birds lay eggs? Because they fly. Why do birds like do anything that they do? It's because all of these sort of physical adaptations are to make sure that flight is physically possible for them, which is you know, one of the reasons why people love birds so much. It's because the flying thing. And it's amazing. Yeah, I'd never thought about why birds' legs were so skinny, but it makes sense. And also, you know, birds, if you take all their feathers out and you actually look at their leg, as you said, Prabita, the knee is the highest point. Most of us here have eaten chicken, so we know sort of what that looks like. It's weird. They just, their whole physiology is just so alien. And I love it. I love that we share this planet with them.
And like when we think about their physiology and like their evolutionary history, for at least for me, it's so often about the wings and the flight, right? Like what I loved about, I'm so happy you chose this article for you to like, I had never really thought that much about the diversity of bird legs. And it's like why I did go on this, like, even within the skinny variety, there are all of these different types of bird legs. Like I ended up looking at pictures of stilt, like you, like stilts, like you mentioned, Prabita, and then also thinking about like, you know, like common yellow throats who are spending a lot of their time in the reeds, and like they're quite different, right? And like, yeah, I hadn't really thought about this variety before. Also, speaking of Easter eggs, in an article, they mention Asher mentions that there are theropods the size of sparrows, which like. That kind of blew. I don't know if that's common knowledge, but like I knew
there were big small dinosaurs, but
yeah, like I knew that. Well, so when I think theropods,
makes sense.
T-Rex, I think it was Spinosaurus, but like tiny. I figured they got smaller, but not sparrow size. Like that's news to me, and that's really cool.
That is pretty wild, and it would be. I want a sparrow sized theropod for a pet. I think it would be delightful to eat cockroaches and whatnot in my garage.
I have to admit, I'm a super dino nerd. Like I love all stuff dino. Like I live in like the dinosaur capital of the world, really.
That's right
here, right? I love all things dinosaur and you know, birds, dinosaurs, they're basically the same as far as I'm concerned. I love this article for a few reasons, because it's fun. and it's a really interesting question. Like, have you looked at like blue gray gnatcatcher legs? Like those things could remove a SIM card from a smartphone. Like
no joke.
They're ridiculous, right? Like unbelievable. But yet they're so strong, right? So, you know, I did like lots of banding work at lots of bird observatories. Mm. And like, if you ever get like a blue jay or even a chickadee, like grab onto you with their feet, it is unbelievably strong. Like it is way stronger than you would ever think.
Blue jay legs are also thicker than you would think.
Yeah,
too.
They are. No, yeah, for sure.
For their size. Yeah.
They're definitely more solid. But like these being like, as Prabita's saying, like primarily tendons and skin, mm-hmm. they pack a punch, right? Like they're really, really strong. I love any discussion that brings up, you know, that the evolution of birds, you know, and many consider birds, you know, as avian theropod dinosaurs, right? As opposed to, you know, the post-Cretaceous extinction of the non-avian theropod dinosaurs, right? And there's a lot of, and in many cases, you actually can't even separate out. Like, you know, if you look at some of the Cretaceous birds, right? It's a coin toss. Is it a bird? Is it a theropod mm-hmm. dinosaur? And, you know, when you're saying, Nate, about like hollow bones and feathers, like actually it wasn't for flight originally, you know, Dromaeosaurus, you know, all the like, Velociraptor, all these things, they had hollow bones, they had feathers, you know, they had all this stuff. They weren't flying with them, right? So some of these things evolved even before flight, which makes it even more amazing mm-hmm. that we've come to this point where it's all about the flight, you know, for the most part, right? It was like all those things worked together so perfectly. That, you know, and luckily they were able to be small because that's the only reason they survived the extinction event at the end of the Cretaceous was because yeah. they were so small, right? So thank goodness they figured that out. But I think there's one thing I want to add is that we're talking about like really, really small and it's really interesting, but I think some people have a tough time seeing, you know, birds as dinosaurs, you know, when they're looking at chickadees or even a downy woodpecker.
I've had a chickadee in my hand. I absolutely believe that it was derived from dinosaurs. Those things are absolutely vicious.
If they were any bigger, right, and had any more intelligence, yes. like we'd be in trouble, right?
Yeah.
So if you've ever seen, let's see, as a golden eagle, for example, mm-hmm. right? We don't think of them, we don't think of like even raptors as having legs, right? We don't think of them, I'm saying this broadly, but in terms of like they have long legs, right? They have long legs and the feathers are hiding so much. Mm-hmm. And I think the feathers are actually hiding the dinosauriness.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's hard to see them as dinosaurs because the feathers make them look like borbs, right? They're like floof balls. But if you ever see a golden eagle walking around with like his wings out, like on the, like out on the prairies here, like you're like, oh my goodness, that is a dromaeosaur. Like that is a full on, that is a raptor, like a Cretaceous raptor, not, you mm-hmm. know, raptor. And you can see it in their legs and the way they walk. And if you see a skeleton of a golden eagle, there you go. It's straight up dinosaur without a tail, right? Yeah. And they've got a beak and, you know, and beaks existed on dinosaurs as well, right? So it's really just missing a tail. That's the only reason, like it you know, it doesn't look like a dinosaur. So I just love any article like this, which sort of brings that up. The dinosaur-ness of birds. Anyway, skinny legs. It makes total sense, right? If you think about it. Wait. Anyway, loved this pick.
Good stuff.
I gave a lecture earlier this week on migratory birds, but early on I mentioned, you know, it's like right after spring break, folks are back, they're kind of there, but they're not really paying attention. And I was mm-hmm. like, I had this slide that was like, if you take nothing else away from today, it's that birds are modern dinosaurs. Every time you walk around the campus and you see all these birds around, you're looking at a dinosaur. Like it's so cool. I think it like really blows people's minds.
I've got some dinosaurs nesting under the eaves of my front porch these days. It's very nice.
Yeah. There you go.
Pet dinosaurs.
Metal.
Yeah, totally.
Absolutely.
All right, let's move on to the question of the month. This month saw the bizarre discovery of a yellow-billed loon in the famous fountains at the Bellagio on the Las Vegas Strip. I talked about it a little bit in an earlier episode this month. Really bizarre sighting, really bizarre place. It does prompt the question, what is the weirdest, most incongruous, most bizarre location where you have seen a notable bird? And I'm leaving the definition of the word notable open to the person giving the answer. That can be anything. Just put the weirdest place you've seen a bird that perhaps you didn't expect.
I can go.
Go for it, Prabita.
Maybe it's not the weirdest. Maybe it's just the freshest in my mind.
Yep.
I honestly haven't chased a lot of birds since the pandemic started. But last month, my friend Harriet and I went to finally see the red-flanked blue tail in, I think, technically southern Jersey. It's in Whiting, yep. New Jersey. I think it's still there.
It is.
It first showed up there in November.
Yep.
Just, you know, a Eurasian migrant that has never been seen in New Jersey, at least. And it showed up in a birder's backyard, which even more than weird, it's just so lucky because it's a very, I would have a very hard time identifying that bird. It's either a female or it's either in juvenile plumage. So it's not even, you know, the traditional breeding plumage of a male red-flanked blue tail. And it's not a bird you would expect at all. So the fact that a birder found it at his feeders, and it was a birder who doesn't mind having hordes of people come onto his property to take a look at this bird and get all his neighbors on board to welcome birders into their housing community, I think that's like, it's just like the perfect storm of, you know, of vagrant sighting, a really cool one. And he even had a plate of cookies out. Like it was so nice. It was so nice.
Cookies and a Eurasian vagrant. Yeah. Sign me up.
They're going to build a statue for this one too.
Like, they should. Nice little time. It'd be like a trophy size statue.
Wait, which one did they build a statue for?
The Great Blackhawk in Maine.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I forgot about that.
Yep.
That's pretty neat.
Also a great story.
So I have two, kind of. Smuggler. One of them is science fiction.
Okay.
So the first thing that came to mind, it's not like regionally weird, but it's more just weird because of where I was and I think where most people are not spending time. So my dad owns a sailboat and he sails out of Chicago on Lake Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And so during migration, he often gets birds like landing on his boat. They're presumably crossing Lake Michigan and get tired and just hang out on his boat. So he's had like magnolia warblers, Lincoln sparrows. I think he's had song sparrows. So every time he sees that, he just sends me a picture and he's like, what is this? And I think it's a fun little thing. Also, I don't know if this has been covered on the podcast already, but I watched Dune 2 this past week.
All right.
No spoilers, please.
Yeah.
I'm still like a month away from my small town theater finally getting the movie. Well, it's torture. It's
he did torturous. Write the book 50 years ago, Jody.
Oh yeah, right. I didn't read the books. Yeah. Thanks for pulling that out, Nate. Yes. I need to read more. Yes.
I'm
true.
Just saying. I'm just sorry. Saying. You're like, okay. When did the spoiler warning reach its reach the expiration?
Yeah. Fair.
So this is maybe a spoiler, but only for birders. I did like a big Dune watching day where I watched Dune 1 during the afternoon and then went to go see the sequel. And I realized watching Dune 1 that on Caladan, which is Paul's home or Timothy Chalamet's character's home planet, that they're Killdeer calling. Which is like
they always stick Killdeer in those places.
Always, right? So it's good to know that, you know, on this extra terrestrial planet that you know, Killdeer are still flapping around and calling out.
There's a Killdeer nest in Atreides' parking lot that they have to put like cones around so that their ships don't run over it. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Atreides like is a much drier planet. The whole thing about Paul's planet.
Oh, okay. There
is that there's a lot of water, right? I guess Killdeer are not particularly like water centric, but yeah, you know, bird diversity in general. Is
that's right.
Yeah.
Bird diversity in the Duneverse.
Yeah.
I've got two quick ones because I just couldn't decide. One, I remember like it must have been over a decade ago. Well, it was like 15 years ago. I was out here in Alberta with my buddies, Yusuf Atiyah, Stu McKenzie. We were doing an Alberta/Canada big day. And we were driving out to get to like where we were going to start. And we're out in the middle of the prairies, totally dry, nothing around, just some long spurs. Like it really, you know, there was not a water body anywhere to be found. And a parasitic Jaeger flew across the grass.
What?
Like a meter off the ground, 2 meters off the ground. Yeah. Just like going straight north across the prairies. It's like, and we're not seeing that tomorrow on our big day for sure.
Yeah.
Guaranteed. We're not seeing that. It's like the only one I've ever seen in this province.
In that situation, you almost want to start your big day right at that moment and go 20 more hours from that point because you're not going to, you got to get that on the list.
I feel like Yusuf suggested that, but we didn't. We didn't do it.
Yep. I know the rules.
Anyway, but the other one, in just weird location, back many, many years ago, I used to work at an outdoor education center up north of Thunder Bay called the Kingfisher Lake Outdoor Ed Center. Amazing, beautiful place up in the Boreal. Lots of skiing, amazing feeders. And we had a couple, like a big school group, and I was at the bird feeders with the school group and talking about all the birds that are there. And it was right on the edge of the driveway. And like, we're in the middle of nowhere. This is like you know, up the Armstrong Highway, you have to Google it. It's like 40 minutes north of Thunder Bay. It's basically the middle of nowhere, and it's also incredible. I'm there with this whole group of kids. We're looking at, I think it was just Pine Grove Speaks and some red poles like at the feeder. And all of a sudden, out of the corner of my eye, I see this thing flying up the driveway and then comes and lands right on the ground, right in front of us underneath the feeder. And it was a band-tailed pigeon. And it was like only a few records for Ontario.
Yeah.
And it was just like landed right in front of the kids. The kids are like, oh, a pigeon. I'm like, that's not just a pigeon. like freaking out, right? I'm like, do I ditch the kids? I need to make some phone calls. Like I didn't have a smartphone. I didn't know what to do. And I like literally was like teacher and I'm like, okay, yeah. So why don't we take a few minutes? Do this. And I like, ran to the phone. And I called, made a call to Nick Escott in Thunder Bay, one of the birders in Thunder Bay. I'm like, there's a band-tailed pigeon up here, you know, and went back to the school group and they were just, you know, we were enjoying the band-tailed pigeon. And then, yeah, after the school group left, all the birders arrived afterwards. But yeah, probably the weirdest, like in the middle of work with a group and band-tailed pigeon just like presented itself like meters from me was like, if only it was always that easy. Hey, that was pretty good.
The best one I have is many years ago, I was leading some field trips for a Carolina Bird Club meeting that was in Greenville, South Carolina, which is a little bit of a drive away from me. And I made the drive with my friend, Scott Winton, who lived nearby. And so Scott and I decided to take kind of this convoluted route from where we were in the Piedmont of North Carolina to Greenville. So we could get as many counties as possible along our route so we could add birds to our county lists in North Carolina. And so we're driving, you know, west of Charlotte, I want to say, through maybe Polk County or Rutherford County. I don't remember which one. But you drive through all these little towns, these kind of, you know, they all look sort of the same. They've all got this strip, the same sort of fast food restaurants on either side of it and like four or five stoplights. And you just got to roll through it each way. And so we pull up to the stoplight and right next to us is a McDonald's. And you know how McDonald's has those sort of rows of kind of ornamental plants that are sort of around the building. And so we're not birding. Our kind of birding radar is, well, it's not completely off, but it's a low simmer. And so we kind of glance, pull up to the stoplight, kind of glance over to the side, and there's this kind of ornamental bush. And like feeding in the middle of this ornamental bush was a Cape May warbler. In a place where there were lots of, you know, house sparrows and rock pigeons and European starlings around. Now, Cape May warbler, but not a terribly uncommon fall migrant for North Carolina. You usually see a handful of them. But I don't think I've ever seen one in the ornamental bushes in front of a McDonald's. So that was the first thing that came to mind. I've also seen some weird stuff when on pelagics, because you never know what you're going to see on pelagics. Mm. And your story about the boat, Miko, reminded me of, I did a pelagic off of San Diego one time with an ABA event. You know, we're out there looking for shearwaters and auklets and storm petrels and all this stuff. And there are some islands that are pretty like 40 miles off of the mainland in San Diego. And as we're watching for birds and everyone's scanning, a big bird kind of flies over from the island over towards the mainland and everyone gets binoculars on it. It's a long-eared owl that is flying like 30 miles out over the ocean from the island, heading back towards the mainland. And I got a very distant photo of it. But yeah, long-eared owl, 30 miles offshore in San Diego is an unexpected one. Although it's not like a loon on the Bellagio. Yeah, the Bellagio. Birds are weird, man.
That's cool. Why birding is great.
Yeah.
I would say fast food restaurant fast food warbler are underbirded. People find like weird gulls in them usually.
Yeah, you know, there's a famous story of the ABA's area's first kelp gull in like the early 90s was at a fast food or a pier in like Ocean City, Maryland, surrounded by people. And you know, I think New York has a bunch of crazy stories about like warblers showing up in the little parks and people feeding them like their house sparrows and stuff. And so
wasn't there a yellow rail at a baseball game?
That's was right, that, at Wrigley Field.
Was that Chicago Cubs game, right?
That's right.
It was like someone photographed a yellow rail.
I remember that. Yeah, I wish I could tell that story because that's a great story. But yeah, I don't think it was birders that even found it. So it was at like an April game at Wrigley Field, and it was on Reddit or some other social media thing. And these people were like, yeah, this weird bird showed up and like tucked in under the benches, and they showed this picture of a yellow rail like sitting underneath the seats at Wrigley Field.
That's
wild.
That is insane. Birding is the best.
You never know. Thank you so much for joining me for another This Month in Birding. Jody Allaire, Miko Jimenez, and Perbita Saha. It's been great talking birds with you, and I hope you have a great spring migration. I'll have links to all the articles that we talked about in the show notes and links to where you can find these great people in there as well. Please check them out. Well, have a great spring. Thanks for joining me, and we'll see you next time.
Good birding, everyone.
Yeah,
thanks,
thank
Nate.
You.
See everyone.
That was a very enjoyable conversation.
The American Birding Podcast is brought to you by the American Birding Association. Don't forget to join the ABA. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll be eligible for a lot of great benefits, including our magazines, all our online stuff like the magazine archive, new identification portal, discounts to partners like OM Systems, Beauty Books, Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and more. Special shout outs this week to Yvette McDonald of San Francisco, California, who joined the ABA and noted this podcast as a reason for doing so. Thank you so much, Yvette. Welcome to the ABA. Executive Director of the ABA and Executive Producer of this podcast is Wayne Klockner, who points out how odd it is that there are 15 species of tailor birds distributed throughout South Asia, but none of them are a swift. Technical production is by John Lowry, who I once took birding at a mudflat that was only accessible through this path, which took us through a forest. It was kind of a long walk, and he kept asking, "Are we out of the woods yet? Are we out of the woods yet? Are we out of the woods yet? Are we out of the woods? Are we in the clear yet? 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 Good." And then he set up a scope. Additional help comes from Maggie Fitzgibbon and Greg Neese, who both traveled to Texas specifically for bare-throated tiger heron, which is on the ABA checklist between the much more common least bittern and great blue heron, adding, muttering, as it was seen, "I've got a blank space, baby. I'll write your name." You can find us online at aba.org and on social media most everywhere as American Birding Association on Blue Sky. We are at ABA Birds. Questions, comments can come to podcast@aba.org. I'm Nate Swick. Thanks for listening. Bird Like Tom. We'll see you next week.